Welcome, this is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it is the 6th of October 2011 here in Japan, but it's still the 5th of October where I in America, where I'm joined on the line by Rick Rozoff, the manager and director of the Stop NATO Coalition, and also an investigative journalist whose work has been featured in such places as Réseau Voltaire and Op-Ed News, as well as the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca. So, Rick Rozoff, it is great to talk to you today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, James.
Well, I know you've done an awful lot of work over the years on NATO specifically and on their various wars and operations that they've been doing around the globe. And as we stand here today on the 5th or 6th of October, depending what side of the dateline you're on, it's only a day or two away from, of course, the 10th anniversary of the NATO occupation of Afghanistan, which unfortunately has been taking place over the past 10 years. So, as we stand on the precipice of this anniversary, obviously it's a time for reflection. So what can you tell us about the 10th anniversary of this occupation and really what the ultimate significance of this is?
That's a tragic one. It's a criminal one. But it's also one fraught with a lot of historical precedents and antecedents, you know, simultaneously. What the 10th anniversary of the U.S. and British attack on Afghanistan on October 7th, 2001, brought in its train is, as you alluded to, you know, 10 years of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, you know, coming in as camp followers initially and then taking over the operation as they continued to manage it under the so-called International Security Assistance Force, where, you know, probably 90% of foreign troops in Afghanistan currently are serving under NATO. That is, you know, that includes, of course, the vast bulk of American troops. It's the largest number of American troops serving under NATO command in history. Outdoes or outnumbers the amount of American troops stationed in Bosnia in 1995. There were 60,000 troops under NATO command. And in Kosovo in 1999, were 50,000 troops, you know, came in under NATO command. But there are a lot of other, you know, rather shocking precedents about this. This is the longest war in the history of the United States. The longest continuous independent combat operations. It's longer than that in Indochina, for example. It's the longest war in the history of Afghanistan. You know, Soviet troops first came into Afghanistan in late December of 1979. And the last ones were pulled out early in 1999, so far less than a decade. It's the largest amount of foreign occupation and combat troops stationed in Afghanistan in that nation's history. A few months ago, the total number is in the area of 152,000, all but perhaps 10,000 under NATO command, under ISAF command. It is NATO's first war in Asia. It is NATO's first ground war. It signifies with anywhere from 4,500 to 5,300 German troops stationed in Kunduz province in the north of Afghanistan, the largest overseas deployment of German troops since World War II, the first combat operations waged by German ground forces since the Hitler regime, with four provinces in the north of Afghanistan assigned by ISAF, by NATO, to NATO partners Sweden and Finland. It represents, in the second case, the first time Finland's been engaged in combat operations since World War II, and in the case of Sweden, in two centuries. And one could go on and on. I would have to say, however, there was an article in Agence France Presse report of yesterday that mentioned that on the 10th anniversary of this war, and again, you know, the first ground combat by German troops since the Third Reich, and what I've mentioned about the Scandinavian countries, you know, until recently, boasted of being neutrals and so forth, that there were no major demonstrations planned in Europe to mark the 10th anniversary of this war. That is not only a scandal, that's a crime. But it testifies to how thoroughly the entire European continent has been NATOized.
Absolutely. Well, it's a rather chilling testament, isn't it? And you listed through just a number of really shocking facts there, but I think one that really stands out for me is that this is the longest conflict in American military history. I mean, that's a striking fact, and the fact that that isn't really cogitated upon very much, and that the anti-war movement has been basically missing in action for the last few years, especially on Afghanistan, if it ever really existed, is really a sad testament to where we've been placed as a society and a civilization. where we just have been really, this has become sort of background information for people, and most people don't even give it a second thought anymore.
Yeah, people are now accustomed to, acclimatized to permanent war. You know, it's my contention that with, you know, in early 1991, with the launching of Operation Desert Storm against Afghanistan, and we have to keep in mind that most NATO nations participate in some manner in that operation. You know, I can't list them immediately, but we know that, you know, France, Britain, and so forth, Turkey, you know, played roles in it. And it was, if you will, a warm-up exercise for all the, or test case for all the wars that would succeed it. But in that full generation, that 20 years, you know, succeeding Operation Desert Storm, you know, there's barely been a week where the U.S. and some NATO ally isn't bombing a country, waging war in a country, or in other manners, you know, involved in military aggression somewhere in the world, with the now, by my count, 201 days of bombardment of, you know, the small North African country of Libya with a total population of perhaps 6 million, 201 days. You know, according to the NATO website this morning, there have been almost 25,000 air missions flown by NATO nations' warplanes. Over 9,000 what they describe as strike sorties, that is combat missions. And, you know, so this signifies, the Libyan war signifies NATO's waging a war in a third continent, you know, after Yugoslavia in 1999, Afghanistan for the past decade, and now North Africa, and they're not stopping there. I think, you know, the fact that China and Russia yesterday vetoed in the United Nations Security Council a resolution calling for more onerous sanctions against Syria, the world interpreted that as trying to put a stop to what would likely be the next NATO attack and so forth. But back to South Asia. As we know, not only you know, has the war escalated to the point, on September 13th, the U.S. Embassy was attacked in the Afghan capital of Kabul. NATO headquarters was attacked in the Afghan capital. Former president during the Mujahideen period, Rabbani, was assassinated shortly thereafter and everything. So anyone who tries to pretend that the Afghan war has been in any manner successful. But, you know, the human cost with Afghans themselves is what's being ignored by the world. And this makes it even more deplorable, you know, even more inexcusable. Refugees International, which is an American non-governmental organization, and by no means a progressive one, estimated a couple months ago that somewhere in the neighborhood of 250,000 Afghans have been displaced from their towns and villages over the past 2 years, primarily by NATO and U.S. bombing and by so-called night raids, that is, attacked by special operation forces and by attack helicopters, and that in the first 6 months of this year, that number was 91,000, meaning which represented twice the amount that had been displaced in the same period last year in 2010. Last year, of course, was the deadliest year of the 10-year war in Afghanistan for U.S. troops, for NATO troops as a whole, for insurgents, for Afghan troops and security personnel, and for Afghan civilians. This is a monstrous debacle, and it's one, as you mentioned, that, you know, the nominal anti-war movement is all but ignored on both sides of the Atlantic and worldwide. But it's also one, James, distressingly enough, where I think one could count on the fingers of one hand the number of 194 now nations in the United Nations that in any way criticize the war.
Yes, well, unfortunately, extremely, extremely sad, but extremely true at the same time. And it is an extremely sad indictment that when you think about the recent escalation in violence in Afghanistan and giving the lie to the idea that somehow NATO is there to bring order or restore order to the country, which they themselves disrupted, it's on its face a lie, but no one is really calling them out on it. And it begs the question, how did America as a society that has historically been so opposed to foreign intervention come to the point where they do accept this permanent war?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could answer that. I mean, that's a wide spectrum of factors, you know, that play a role in it. people's self-absorption, their cultural and social and moral corruption. I'll say this if no one else will. People are not going to rise up and take a principled and a courageous stand if they have something to hide. You know, if they're so self-absorbed and concentrated on, personal peccadilloes and, hobbies and distractions and so forth. The fact, of course, that the U.S. has a so-called professional, volunteer army now, as opposed to a conscript army, as they did during the war in Vietnam, is, of course, a factor. But, that indicates that if one's fat is in the fire, you oppose war, but if it isn't, you don't. The U.S. casualties are not of such dimensions that it, has become a crisis in the United States and so forth. But, the political and the moral aspects or facets of this seem to be missing. It's perfectly all right to wage a low-cost, in terms of, American lives, low-cost war anywhere in the world. I mean, to the point where President Obama, recently took issue with legal advisors and legal scholars on the question of the monstrous, drone attacks inside Pakistan, which have cost the lives of perhaps 3,000 people. The vast bulk of them since he walked into the Oval Office, by stating, and using drones also in Libya recently, and stated, basically, in so many words, if American soldiers aren't placed in harm's way, then it's not war.
Exactly. So I suppose if we just dropped a nuclear weapon on a foreign country without having any troops committed to the region, then I suppose that would not be war.
Yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate reductio ad absurdum of that, isn't it? I mean, but it's true. According to that logic, to preemptively use nuclear weapons against someone where you don't, with long-distance missiles, as opposed to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where some pilot might have been shot down, that if you don't risk the life of an American service person in any way or form, then, it's not war.
Well, I mean, obviously on its face, ridiculous, but unfortunately that's kind of the Orwellian times that we're living in, where war is peace and all of that kind of nonsense. And just speaking more to the idea of the overall escalation that we've seen in Afghanistan over the years, including, of course, the expansion into the AFPAC war zone that the Obama administration brought, and also recent reports, for example, in August of this year, NATO to deliver Iron Mountain of military gear to Afghanistan, talking about $2.7 billion of military equipment that's going to be delivered on behalf of NATO to the Afghans as the drawdown supposedly starts to begin, and they have to take over security for themselves, just arming them to the hilt with all of these weapons. So can you speak to the overall escalation that we've seen over the years in this conflict?
The escalation, as we mentioned, went from, at one point early on in the war, somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000 U.S. troops and a small contingent of British troops to, as of my calculations, U.S. military figures, earlier this year of 152,000 troops. I think another remarkable, and this is, Soviet troops at their peak were, during the 1980s, per person, the range of 130,000, 140,000 or so. So this is, again, the largest foreign military force that's ever been stationed in Afghanistan. But I think what's even more noteworthy, and again is being ignored, is that the amount of what are called troop-contributing countries, that's the official designation, or troop-contributing nations, I believe, by NATO, is officially 48. And then in addition to that, you have perhaps another half dozen nations that have contributed military personnel in some way or form. So you have over 50 nations, well over a quarter of the total nations in the world, who have from small to fairly large troop contingents in Afghanistan serving under the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in South Asia. And these countries, if you include a rumored, deployment of Colombian troops, of about a year or so ago, and the fact that there are Egyptian personnel there, you have military forces from every inhabited continent serving under NATO in Afghanistan. So this is much more than just, the devastations being wreaked on the country and the carnage on its people that we're talking about, but we're talking about the U.S. using NATO as an international military intervention and strike force. and integrating the militaries of well over a quarter of the nations in the world into that strike force. There's a meeting of NATO defense ministers in Brussels even as we speak, and they rarely divulge how many countries or which countries are invited to send their defense ministers in addition to the 28 NATO full members. But there have been meetings of the NATO military committee, which is not of defense ministers, but or either of defense ministers or chief of defense staff. That is, the equivalent of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States, for example, where 70 countries have been represented. Talking about Afghanistan, 70 countries. So I can't help but think, and I thought for years that amongst other purposes that the war in Afghanistan serves or has served in the United States and NATO, is the opportunity of using it as a training ground for breaking in the militaries, integrating the militaries of countries throughout Eurasia in the first place, but ultimately throughout the world for further such operations. On the eve of the NATO summit in Lisbon, Portugal last autumn, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the Secretary General of NATO, was quoted by the Daily Telegraph in Britain as saying the Afghan war is a template for future NATO operations. So, far from having their fingers singed and, thinking better of a second such operation, they immediately follow up, of course, in Libya and with maritime operations off the coast of Somalia, something called Operation Shield, which is going to be a permanent NATO operation, and the very real prospect of military action against countries like Syria and who knows who else. So the Afghan war has permitted the U.S. first of all, U.S. and NATO, to situate themselves right in the middle. And then we should recall that the invasion of October 7th of 2001, followed by maybe 3.5 months, the founding of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization with Russia, China, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. And that efforts made by regional countries, which would also include now observer nations of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, like India, Pakistan, and Iran, to forge some, common economic, energy, security, and so forth, plan for Central and South Asia, for vast tract of Eurasia as a whole, has essentially been sabotaged or thwarted by the planting of U.S. and NATO military, forces in that area. We should also recall that after NATO invoked its Article 5 Mutual Military Assistance Clause for the first and to date only time after the events of 9/11/01 in this country, that not only did they endorse participation in the war in Afghanistan, which has kept their respective nations' troops there for a decade, but they also NATO emerged, as a global strike force, as I alluded to earlier. We're talking about troop contributing nations. Of the last nine or so of those, I believe every one of them, or every one but one, is a nation that, in the largest sense of the word, would be considered an Asia Pacific country. Japan has sent medics recently. They're not an official troop-contributing country, but they've sent military medics. Australia has 1,550 troops serving under NATO. It's the largest non-full NATO member contribution. Recently, several other countries like Malaysia, Mongolia, have sent troops. Pressure was exercised on nations like Kazakhstan and Bangladesh to send troops. So we're seeing the Afghanistan-Pakistan war also as an opportunity of building up what has been referred to over the past decades, James, as an Asian NATO.
Yes, well, as someone living in Japan, I can say it is quite disturbing to see firsthand over the last several years how it seems that the public is being slowly and softly conditioned into accepting a greater and greater role for its military overseas in direct violation of its own constitution. And thankfully, there is still a very strong anti-war sentiment among the general population here, but it is a question, I think, of a long-term psychological conditioning process, which unfortunately we've seen taking place overseas as well.
Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution that forbids so-called collective self-defense and so forth.
That's right.
You know, what we have seen is Japan has now opened its first overseas military base since World War II in the Horn of Africa nation of Djibouti, where they're joining some 2,500 to 3,000 U.S. troops at Camp Le Manier, perhaps another 2,000 or 3,000 French troops, and at various times troops from other NATO nations. This is also part of the post-9/11 NATO expansion into Africa and into Northeast Africa in the first instance. But we also see where Japan is now going to permit the United States to use interceptor missiles produced in Japan to be sold to third parties, which are NATO nations and Israel. So, a few years ago, Japanese military vessels were refueling and providing supplies to U.S. Warships in the Indian Ocean for the war in Afghanistan. But this was part of so-called Operation Enduring Freedom. The fact that Japan has sent a nominal but symbolically important contingent of military medics to Afghanistan under NATO command, suggests something beyond decades-long U.S.-Japanese bilateral military cooperation. It suggests that Japan is, by the way, Japan is one of four nations at the moment that NATO refers to as contact countries. The others are South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand. All four have troops now in Afghanistan serving under NATO. And it's if one goes to the NATO website, you'll see under press releases or news. Quite frequently, military and defense officials from the four countries I've just mentioned visit NATO headquarters. They are being integrated into what I would argue has become the world's first attempt at a global military alliance.
Extremely disturbing, and yet we're asked to believe that this Afghanistan occupation has all been the result and a consequence of what was alleged to be an attack by Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden 10 years ago. What can you say about the cartoon-level propaganda of the reasons that are being given for this war?
I mean, it is precisely cartoonish. It's what I've at times referred to as comic book Manichaeism. They have the Superman and they have the archvillain and du jour. We should keep in mind, that the recent, not so much statements, but threats by major American officials, including the new Defense Secretary, Leon Panetta, and recently retired Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Michael Mullen, saber-rattling at Pakistan and demanding, the sovereign nation and an ally, as it were, that they clamp down on something called the Haqqani Network, which is a group of Afghan fighters, eponymous, it was named after the founder, Jalaluddin Haqqani, who in the 1980s was one of the major recipients of U.S. military and financial aid when he was based in Pakistan, waging cross-border raids inside Afghanistan. At that time, he was a hero. And Stanley McChrystal, when he was still commander of both U.S. And all NATO forces in Afghanistan 2 years ago, issued a ISAF commander's assessment, which was presented to Obama, and was used, as the basis for the increase, the escalation of U.S. deployment at the time. And he identified three groups that the United States and NATO were fighting in Afghanistan. One of them was the Taliban group, one based in the capital of Balochistan in Pakistan. The other two, interestingly enough, were the Haqqani Network and something called Hezbi Islami Gulbuddin, which is the political party of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. Hekmatyar was the major recipient of U.S. Monies under the CIA's reportedly largest covert operation in the history of the agency, Operation Cyclone, which began actually in the in the late 70s and extended through 1992, and the likes of Haqqani and Hekmatyar took over the country. So, one has to have a very short memory or an amazing tolerance for contradiction to believe that the United States is, fighting terrorists which threatened it, when in fact it their own commander identifies the enemies as at least former clients of the United States.
Indeed. Well, I think Rick Rozoff, now would be a good time to mention the Stop NATO website at rickrozoff.wordpress.com. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about the work that you've done over the years on this issue.
Yeah, thank you for that opportunity. The Stop NATO website came out of Stop NATO International email news list, which was set up by a very young, at the time, Spanish student in Britain named Javier Bernal, and to his great credit. And this was during the 78-day bombing campaign against Yugoslavia in the spring of 1999, rather. And the list continued, at the time, but it was very difficult, as we talked about at the beginning of our discussion, James. It was very difficult to get people interested in it, and for several years, because, what NATO was doing more or less out of sight of the world press was being documented on our email list, painstakingly, on a daily basis. But until something surfaces, like the war in Afghanistan or the current war against Libya, people tend to, pay attention to other matters. And as a matter of fact, on the eve of 9/11/01, the two major stories that we were following the most closely on Stop NATO was NATO's intervention into the Balkan nation of Macedonia, where they essentially forced a branch of the so-called Kosovo Liberation Army on the government in Skopje, in Macedonia, and efforts made in Georgia to, infiltrate fighters into the Russian North Caucasus. So, those are burning issues, and 9/11, of course, wiped those off the map. And so what's, I think I would say, with both the website and the email list, we're not going for topical items. We're going for exploring as best we can the ongoing structural development of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization as a U.S.-dominated global strike force. And that is the story. Which country they attack tomorrow is, in a sense, of less importance than the fact that they are building up an international capacity to use military force whenever and wherever they, the United States and NATO, choose to do so.
I would just say a very insightful analysis, because it does strike me that NATO is really the glove that fits around the iron fist of the American military and gives it some sort of a veneer of international approval. So I think it is important and absolutely at the core of any true anti-war movement to be looking at NATO and scrutinizing it at an institutional level. So again, let me commend you on that work and direct people to rickrozoff.wordpress.com to stay up to date with these stories and issues. And it does make me wonder why I haven't had you on the Corbett Report before, but I certainly hope that you'll join us again in the future to continue going over these very important issues.
I'd be very glad to. If I could just mention real quickly at the end, I talked about the NATOization of Europe. And, depending on how you count European countries, whether you include the South Caucasus, for example, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, and excluding micro-states like Andorra and San Marino and so forth, every single European nation is either now a full member of NATO or a member of one or more than one NATO partnership, which is, say, apprenticeship programs, except for Cyprus. And there is the small island nation of Cyprus, and there's an effort afoot right now, a pretty intense one, to force them into the so-called Partnership for Peace, which is a transitional program NATO has used to expand its membership from 16 to 28 members in a decade, from 1999 to 2009. We're seeing now Rasmussen, the Secretary General of NATO, a couple of days ago, stating that NATO is going to expand its partnerships throughout the Mediterranean, the Middle East, and the Persian Gulf, and in his own words, we hope that Libya will be one of those partners. So, we're talking about something much grander than I think people have made the effort to realize up until now. And we're dealing with something that is, NATO, which has attempted to supplant the United Nations, effectively has, by using or misusing UN resolutions nowhere, more strikingly than in Afghanistan, incidentally. And that, people have two choices. They can have a world ruled by a U.S. military bloc. And when I talk about the entire European continent being subsumed under NATO, I'm talking about, that is to say, under a country on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. Which alone, I should think, would bring out demonstrators in Europe, for the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan, if nothing else does. Mm-hmm.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And it is it's just striking to really contemplate how we've been brought to this brink. And it is interesting, again, as you note, the Russian and Chinese veto of the Syrian sanctions, as everyone starts to really understand that UN resolutions are now really just an excuse for NATO cover or NATO bombardment. So very. Exactly. Well, very interesting times. And as I say, this is a much, much bigger issue than a lot of people are giving credit for. So I certainly hope that that you will join us again in the future. But for now, let's leave it there. Rick Rozoff, Stop NATO International, thank you so much for your time today.
No, thank you for yours.